It's 1320 AM and W248DE broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
Stop surfing the dial. You've found the greatest radio station ever. Locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Steve Kathan. After the rain, dealing with a mountain of mud.
It was very terrifying when it started because it's trees and debris.
That California woman and thousands of others looking to bounce back after 2 weeks of storms.
California has been drenched by 9 atmospheric rivers since the beginning of the year. San Francisco has received 17 inches of rain. The average is around 3.
The rain is always helpful with our drought. The problem is just getting too much of it in too short of a time.
National Weather Service meteorologist Sean Miller. 41 counties have declared a federal emergency and 20 people have died. Still, California could use more wet weather, says Sean de Guzman with the State Department of Water Resources.
We'll need consecutive storms month after month after month to help really refill our reservoirs.
Matt Bigler for CBS News, San Francisco.
Also in San Francisco, jury selection today in a trial that's expected to put Elon Musk on the stand. It's the result of an investor lawsuit after Musk claimed on Twitter in 2018 that he'd lined up financing to take Tesla private. Legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum.
The judge had already ruled that the tweets about the purchase of Tesla were false and that Musk was reckless in making them. That's a key finding.
A failed Republican candidate in New Mexico, convinced last fall's election was rigged and he'd been cheated, is accused in a series of shootings at the homes of elected Democrats. Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller.
This was about a right-wing radical, an election denier, and someone who did the worst imaginable thing you can do when you have a political disagreement, which is turn that to violence.
Solomon Pena is accused of masterminding the shootings. No one hurt. Police say 4 others were also involved. There are calls for changes in the L.A. Police Department 2 weeks after a teacher was killed in a stun gun incident with police. Patrice Cullors is a cousin of the victim.
There could have been mental health professionals or physical health professionals who showed up to the scene to really establish a container so that my cousin could have went to the hospital much sooner. He was asking for help. He was begging for help, and he didn't receive that.
Also under investigation is a fatal shooting involving police that same day 2 weeks ago. Overseas, CBS's Vicky Barker tells us.
Beijing says China's population shrank last year for the first time since the Great Famine of 1961. The population of 1.4 billion shrank by 850,000, while the over 60s now account for nearly 20% of the population. The fear is that could slam the brakes on China's economic growth.
Wall Street, right now the Dow is down 326 points. The NASDAQ is up 10 points. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
As a Walgreens pharmacist, I talk with people all the time about little tips and tricks for filling their Medicare prescriptions, like taking advantage of Walgreens 90-day refills to save them a trip, or using Refill by Scan, which is super easy and right on your phone. And for anybody worried about prescription costs, I say, hey, we got you. With low-cost copays on many medications.
Let's talk about making things easier. Walgreens is here. Fill your way and save at walgreens.com/Medicare. See pharmacists for restrictions and exclusions.
Did you know you can get your prescriptions for less at your local pharmacy? You can with GoodRx. It's the free app that can save you money on your medications. Just search for your prescription, choose the pharmacy and the price that works best for you, and then show your GoodRx coupon to your pharmacist at the drop-off counter. GoodRx works at over 70,000 pharmacies, including Walmart, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, and it works whether you have insurance or not. It's easy to save. Next time you drop off your prescription, check GoodRx. To start saving today, go to GoodRx.com. GoodRx is not insurance.
Ladies and gentlemen, children at heart and of all ages,
start your day laughing with Mornings on WFHR.
7 to 10, Monday through Friday, join your host James and the best co-hosts in radio.
Keep up to date on local news, sports, and weather.
Along with Misty's Menu, Birthday and Anniversary Club, and Friday's Culver's Star of the Day.
Join the conversation weekdays 7 to 10 for Mornings on WFHR. We're a serious comedy to start your day.
For Civic Media, I'm Melissa Kay with your local news update. A sex offender is being released in Marathon County. Tyler D. Custer has reached his mandatory release date from his prison sentence. Tyler Custer will be released back into Marathon County on January 24th and placed on intensive supervision by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections until January 30th of 2030. Wisconsin Republicans want to put welfare on April ballots statewide. The Senate takes up the advisory referendum bill today. The proposed question would ask if able-bodied, childless adults should have to look for work in order to get public benefits. It hardly matters since jobless Wisconsinites already have to look for work to get food stamps and unemployment. The move is seen as a way to drive voter turnout for conservatives running for state Supreme Court. In sports, the Bucks host Toronto tonight. And that's the news on your locally grown radio station.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Daytime highs approaching 36 this afternoon under cloudy skies with scattered rain showers likely. West winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Scattered rain showers again tonight. Lows dip down to about 26. Overcast. Overcast skies tomorrow. High of 33. 5 to 10 inches of snow tomorrow night through Thursday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 35.
I open my door. I got some neighbors that open their door.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today on your lunch hour. As always, you can join the conversation at 844-967-2789. And so it's not breaking news that Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And for some people, they know how it got that way. But for a lot of us, it's kind of this just it is. But in reality, it became that way by design. And so two University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee professors are leading an effort to document and map what shaped the racial geography of not only just the city, but Milwaukee County in a project called Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County. So here today to help us talk about the project are those two professors, Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds. Derek is an assistant professor in the English Department of Public Rhetoric and Community Engagement at UWM. And Ann Bonds is an associate professor and associate chair of geography and an affiliate faculty member of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
So let's just start, because I think sometimes people come to this conversation around segregation in Milwaukee. And it's not just a story of Milwaukee. I mean, I think Chicago, you see Chicago and Detroit and so many other large metropolitan areas. I think a lot that during the last century, like a century ago, kind of how they forced people to live in certain neighborhoods. And so the tactic I'm more familiar with is redlining. So for people who don't know what redlining is, could either of you explain that?
There's been a great deal of interest in redlining, and it's really wonderful that everybody's learning more about this. Redlining maps come from an institution, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, established by the federal government following the Depression, really to try to stabilize housing prices. And the Homeowners Loan Corporation was tasked with essentially mapping over 200 cities and their kind of real estate markets to identify places where it would be safe to invest and areas that would be, as they were termed, risky for investment. So it was really, these maps were used, they kind of graded neighborhoods or areas of the city. And so redlined areas are called such because they were colored red on these maps. And these were places that were marked as risky or not safe for financial lending, and essentially barring whole neighborhoods or portions of cities from mortgage lending. And so certainly redlining had a powerful effect on segregation. But what we're here to talk with you about today is racial covenants, which actually existed before these maps were made, and they were being utilized. And in fact, sometimes the redlining maps were drawn around areas with covenants.
So that was what, and in learning about the project, I've heard of like the handshake deals that was kind of like the implicit like understanding of who you sold your house to. But when reading more about the project, it was the first time I've even heard this term covenant. So can you tell you more about what those were and how prevalent and prominent they were in Milwaukee County?
Sure. Covenants are just clauses that are inserted into property deeds, and they stipulate how a property can be used, what the appearance should look like of properties, even the value of properties. So when you get into these covenants, you're reading things about garage setbacks, for example, or the building heights that are required the stipulations for building heights in neighborhoods. And what also is included in here, up until, you know, they were made illegal, were racial covenants, which explicitly stated that certain groups were not allowed to live in certain areas. And they are actually quite extensive and detailed, often in terms of their legality. There'll be long stipulations in these covenants about, you know, nobody can live here, but also after you sell the house, even the successors or heirs to this property can't sell. So they're very explicit in barring people of color, especially African Americans, from neighborhoods.
And even though they're illegal, some of this language is still present today in people's deeds, their housing deeds. There was a person who told me from Madison when her and her husband bought the house, they were reading, one of the few people who actually read all of
the fine print,
right.
The terms of service.
Right. And they came across this and said, hey, what's this? So it's, even though it, like I said, even though it's out, it's illegal in some places, it's still in their deeds.
And so the fact that it's still in the deeds in some places, is that just because people don't read the fine print and it just it continues to exist? Or is there people who are still complicit and just trying to get away with it?
They're not functional, so they don't serve the purpose that they were designed to initially.
Okay.
So they can't be used, but they certainly have a symbolic power. They tell you about the history of a neighborhood, how it was formed, who was excluded. They're written into the deed. Oftentimes, these were meant to run with the land. It's often stated, which means that it runs with the property, and so they're just included in that legalese language. And so, yeah, you know, this people's interest in this project means that a lot of folks have gone out and gone to look at their own property records and see what they can find, and they're finding that yes, in fact, there were racial covenants, there was a racial covenant attached to their property, and they didn't know about it because it's buried in, you know, all of these documents. And you can access the original property record for any property at the Register of Deeds office. And, you know, they can help you find it. It's somewhat difficult or it can take some time. You definitely need the support of the people in the office. And you can see your original property record. And that's where you would find these kinds of details.
So the project, mm-hmm, seems kind of like a Herculean task of what you both are set out to do with the help of a lot of volunteers. So tell me more and tell the audience more about what the project is.
Well, I think I'm going to let Ann talk a little bit more because she began this process early on. She was going to the deed register's office and kind of looking these up one at hand. So I'll let you share the story and then I'll show. When I jump in.
Sounds good. Well, I'm interested in segregation and race, and I always, as a geographer, feel like maps are a really powerful way to help us see the way that social dynamics become embedded or connected to certain places. And so I teach a class called the Geography of Race, and I had seen a couple of examples where people had made these interfaces to show the history of segregation. And I was interested in doing this myself, kind of thinking about the way that all of these things kind of overlapped and created these various boundaries in the city for people of color. And, you know, the redlining itself, how did the redlining maps and the Hulk map for Milwaukee from 1938 connect to these other dynamics? And so I started digging into covenants, and I knew they existed. There's a great report written by Lois Quinn from 1979, which cataloged some of these. And so, of course, we're grateful for her work. But there's nothing exhaustive because it's very difficult. And we're talking, of course, about thousands and thousands and thousands of documents. So it is a Herculean effort in that respect. And so somewhere along the line, as I was, you know, one semester, I always tell the story because it kind of gives you a sense that, you know, my research assistant and I were combing through records. And one semester, we were really excited because we found about 50 that hadn't been documented before, which was great. But, you know, when we're talking about thousands and thousands of racially restrictive covenants that likely exist, we knew that this was going to be something that would take years and years and years.
Yeah.
And then I met some colleagues at the University of Minnesota. They had a project called Mapping Prejudice, and they're now people that we collaborate with. And they had this really innovative way of doing the project where they got digitized copies of the property records. And so what we've done the same thing. And then they run this through software, an optical character recognition software, and they're actually flagging certain terminology using scripts, but to flag language. So we know that Caucasian is a word, Caucasians only, whites. We see the language, apologies in advance to listeners for offensive language. We see terms like colored people. We see terms like African. We see they through all of their research and support of our project, they become experts on these, and they've helped us kind of put together a set of words to flag. And so from that then, so we initially started with 1.7 million images.
Oh my God.
And we took those images were converted to text, they're run through the software, and now we have a core data set of about 21,000 records. And so we're going through those records now with volunteers, which is the important part of the process. We're working together with volunteers to look at those deeds and say, yes, do they have a covenant, or no, do they have a covenant?
Yeah.
Because machines aren't humans and they make mistakes. And so there are certain things that could be flagged that could be like racial language that might be flagged. And it turns out, nope, they're not actually covenants. So that's the process we're in right now, is working through those covenants with volunteers.
Got it. So we're talking to UWM professors Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds about their Mapping Racism and Resistance in Milwaukee County project. And so I think it's interesting because a geography professor and a English professor walk into a bar. It's like the beginning of a joke. And so quickly, we'll come back and talk more about the project and the importance of it and what it can accomplish by the volunteers and really being able to map this. But as far as the two disciplines and how they overlap for this project, how did they... Because I think people tend to think literature and English sits over here and geography and urban studies sits over here. And so how do you two see the two disciplines working together on this project?
Well, so this is where I come into the story. So when I first came to UWM, I was familiar with Anne's work. And so I reached out to her just to talk about her work, and because there was an article that she had wrote that I found very interesting. And we met and we talked, and she first mentioned this project that she was doing. I think this was early in 2020. So it was in the back of my head. And then, of course, as we know, the summer of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, and there was this awakening. My own work, I look at the ways in which African-American communities respond to urban renewal in the 50s and 60s. So I'm very interested in Black organizing. I am in English department, but my work is interdisciplinary. And so I remember her project, and I reached out to her and to see where it was. And we met and we discussed, and we came up with this approach to the project now, that we wanted to map the racism and resistance, because this is something that the African-American community already knew about early in the 20th century. We're very familiar with the, you know, open housing marches in the late 60s, but the Black community, Black Milwaukee, had been protesting, resisting these housing practices way back in the 1920s, if not earlier. So I wanted, you know, we wanted to tell the whole story. And so that's kind of like how we came together. Yeah. And neither one of us is a, you know, a history, you know, professor. So we've had help from our research team.
So I'm going to cut you off.
Sure.
We're coming back right after the break. Professor Derek Hanley and Ann Bonds will still be here to talk about Mapping Racism and Resistance. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Just really trying to break in. Get away from my car. Get away.
Light the lamp.
All the way down, he scores! A 200-foot empty net goal for the captain.
And defend the ice.
Driving in, centering pass. Oh, great sliding left pad save.
This is America's college hockey capital.
Fire one towards the net and scores.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger hockey.
right here on WFHR, locally grown radio, your home for Wisconsin sports.
When a student lacks basic needs like food, clothing, and learning materials, attending school can be a challenge.
And that can make it impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue by ensuring that students have everything they need to re-engage in learning,
access to technology and school supplies,
and even emotional support.
By bringing communities of support to students, we're achieving equitable learning conditions.
And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
Learn more at communitiesinschools.org.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
From the home of the Cranberry Blossom Festival, your news, talk, and sports station is locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. Choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
We are here with Professor Ann Bond and Derek Hanley, and we were talking a little too much with the break, and now we're back. Jane's giving me the eye. She's like, are you going to talk? But we are talking about the Mapping Racism and Resistance Project that they've started over at UWM. And Professor Hanley, I'll let you finish the point you were talking about before we had to break.
Yes. That's just basically what I was saying is this is how the project came about. And we've been very happy about the reception and people wanting to volunteer and how much they want to be a part of it, because this is a community project, and we've thought of it as such. And so the community is helping us with this project and to tell this larger story.
And so with that, I mean, besides just the fact that you need people power to go through 21,000 documents that is already down from over a million documents. But as far as the qualitative benefit, both for the project, but also for the people who are going to volunteer to help go through this, what do you think the value of that is to have so many more people just from the public and not academia be involved?
We've had folks ask this question, you know, with AI software, you know, we could just use AI software, we wouldn't need to do this. And we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
We clearly rely on digital methods in multiple ways on the project. But what we have found and our collaborators is that reading the deeds is incredibly powerful. It's a really important opportunity for us to understand and read and engage with the way that these deeds and this kind of these mechanisms were at work. I think you started out our interview saying, you know, we just kind of understand segregation as kind of just the way it is, or it's just kind of normalized. But, you know, people are very surprised when they see the ways in which, you know, there's an active role that homeowners, real estate developers, home builders, insurers, that we're all kind of involved in this process. And so it's really revealing for people to really, I think it's powerful for people to learn that their properties have covenants themselves and to kind of reflect and think on that. But it's also just in terms of the community, it's helping us to understand how we got to where we are. So I think there's a really important learning point. And of course, just learning about histories of racism and the way that their legacies continue, in our own urban environments.
And if I just you get insight to the ways in which race was conceptualized in the early 20th century in the language. And we like to prepare folks that you're going to read some things that's very problematic.
Yeah.
And possibly be upsetting, because it's right there. It's one thing to hear that a place is historically segregated. It's another thing to read it and to see it and how matter of fact it was and how it was written into to these deeds, that if a person sold their house to someone who was not of the white race, that they were at risk of losing their home.
Wow.
Forfeiture. So this is what we mean by, you know, when it said it's by design, there was legal consequences if you violated these deeds.
And so when the project, at least the goal, when the project is done, how do you two envision it living on as far as consumption for more people to be able to understand it? Like, do you see it as literally being a map?
Yeah, it will literally be a map, but it will be a digital resource embedded on a website, which right now we just kind of have a placeholder while we're, you know, doing this part of the project. But we'll have a lot of maps. People will be able to search these maps. They'll be able to look up their own properties. So we've done some of the legwork, or we will have at some point in time when these are up. And we also have resources documenting, as Derek said earlier, how Black Milwaukeeans and their allies were challenging these efforts. So we'll have, you know, we'll kind of have this, these kind of interactive maps. And it's also a website that we hope we can collect people's stories. And already we're hearing a lot of stories. People have reached out to us to tell us about their own covenants or their family's experiences being excluded from certain neighborhoods because of their racial identity. And so we want this resource to be a tool, community produced and community, you know, it'll be owned at the university, but at the same time, we want it to be a resource for anybody who wants to go and learn more about this or who needs the information for their own purposes, community groups, city leaders, for anybody.
Yeah. So then last question, are you still looking for volunteers? How many volunteers do you need in total, or what's the hope?
Well, we're about, I think we were just talking about this, a fifth of the way through our 21,000 the documents that we need to read through. So clearly we are still in need of volunteers. You can be a volunteer and just look through one document, as some people are. They do it once and they get the experience and they learn from it. Or you can be a volunteer who does hundreds, and we have some volunteers that are very invested in this and they've been doing it. So we're looking for all levels of support if people have time and interest. We'll share more information about upcoming. We have both virtual transcription events, and then we'll have future in-person events throughout the coming spring and summer until we're done. And I can kind of preview that we'll be releasing some preliminary maps in March. So we'll have some maps up to, because teasers to keep interest alive as we're working through these along the way.
All right. Well, we will put all of the information if you are interested in volunteering, because you don't have to be in Milwaukee, right?
No, nope.
You can do it virtually.
Yep. Do it virtually
anywhere from in the state. We will put
or the country. We have people all over the place. Yeah.
There you go.
And can I just add one thing?
Yep.
That each deed has to be verified from five different people. So
that's why we
need so many volunteers. Because we want to verify the language in these deeds. So each deed has to have five different readers of it.
Thank you, Derek. I forgot to mention that.
That is an important distinction. Okay. So if you are interested in this project, we will have all the information of how you can sign up and learn more on our episode blog for today. Professor Ann Bonds, Professor Derek Hanley, thank you so much for making the trip to Waukesha and being here in person today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back in just a minute. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
News, talk, and sports on both sides of the dial from Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
If you've been listening, you know you can get your free credit report at annualcreditreport.com. But how do you use it? Paying attention to key pieces of information on the report, including your personal information, open credit accounts, and credit inquiries can help you not only understand your credit standing and catch any errors, but regularly checking your credit report may also help you identify potential fraud or identity theft. Everyone is entitled to a free credit report from each of the three main credit bureaus once every 12 months. Yet only one in three Wisconsin adults actually obtain the report each year. An easy way to remember to check your report is to simply mark your calendar. Picking dates like February 2nd or 2-2 make it even easier to remember. Go to annualcreditreport.com to get started with your free credit report, and don't forget to keep listening for more tips. This message has been brought to you by the United Way of Southwood and Adams County's Financial Stability Coalition.
I lived alone and was having problems with my landlord. He's a creep. One night I'm watching TV and I hear my landlord letting himself in. Hey, get out. You can't keep coming in.
I'm just here to fix your fridge and spend some time together.
Get out. I'm reporting you.
Don't make a federal case of it.
A federal case? Sexual harassment in housing is against federal law. If you are harassed, file a complaint with HUD. Go to hud.gov/fairhousing. If you fear for your safety, call 911. Fair Housing, the law is on your side. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
This message is sponsored by WiskCaregiver.com. Have you ever wondered if a career in healthcare is right for you? Now is the time to start a meaningful career, making a real difference in people's lives. WISC Caregiver Careers is a free employment and training program and is launching 3,000 caring individuals into healthcare careers. Register today at WiskCaregiver.com. In minutes, we'll connect you with participating employers within 50 miles of your home. Once hired, you'll start earning while you're learning to become a certified nurse aide. Plus, you'll receive a $500 retention bonus. Take the first step that will change your life. Register today at WiskCaregiver.com. All caring individuals of any age can take advantage of this opportunity to get paid while training for nurse aide certification. Give back to those who need you the most. Get hired today at WiskCaregiver.com. This message was sponsored by WISC Caregiver Careers, a free employment and training program.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media, I'm Melissa Kay with your local news update. The Badger Institute commended the flat tax legislation proposed by Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu. They say LeMahieu's proposal will be beneficial for almost all businesses. They claim it will produce long-term economic growth and opportunity and benefit all Wisconsinites. LeMahieu's proposal would phase in a flat income tax rate of 3.25% by 2026. Governor Tony Evers said he would block the plan as it benefits the wealthy over the middle class. Low and middle income earners would see little to no relief, while the wealthiest earners would see their tax rate cut in half. A Texas brewery is canceling a scheduled rally featuring Kyle Rittenhouse. The Illinois man was acquitted of homicide charges in Wisconsin related to the Kenosha riots of 2020. Officials with Southern Star Brewing say the so-called rally against censorship doesn't reflect their values. Rittenhouse says he's disappointed. And that's the news on your locally grown radio station.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Daytime highs approaching 36 this afternoon under cloudy skies with scattered rain showers likely. West winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Scattered rain showers again tonight. Lows dip down to about 26. Overcast. Overcast skies tomorrow. High of 33. 5 to 10 inches of snow tomorrow night through Thursday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 35.
From the Forward Analytics, which is the research arm of Wisconsin Counties Association, and we're going to continue the conversation about housing because they just put out a new report titled A Housing Hurdle, Demographics Drive Need for More Homes. And in that report, on the low end, they said that the state needs to build at least 140,000 housing units by 2030 to keep up with demand. And so I was fascinated with this because I think whether we're talking about Madison zoning, we're talking about condos, but I know in Green Bay, like everywhere around the state, affordable housing is an issue. And yet it's also coupled with and doesn't see, it seems conflicting in when we talk about population and in everywhere but Dane County having a declining working age population. And so here to help us kind of make sense of all of this is Mr. Dale Knapp. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here today.
So let's just start from the beginning, because I think sometimes like needing the definition or starting with a definition is important. So when we talk about affordable housing, what does that actually mean?
Well, first, let me go back even one step before that. So for this report, and people ask us that when we're talking about housing, so people oftentimes just think single family homes, but this we're talking in, you know, in terms of need, this is a combination of single family homes, condominiums, apartments, you know, sort of the whole gamut. So we're not just talking single family homes. When we're talking about affordable housing, and we got into that a little bit, but affordable housing typically is defined housing in which your housing costs are under 30% of your income. That's generally what's considered affordable.
And because I think sometimes people, when they hear affordable housing, they think of like Section 8 of like low income housing. And those are two different things, right?
Two different things, definitely. Yes.
And so what this report looked at is the decline or the lack of supply of housing that's available for people who, and that falls in their income being, or that falls under the cost being less than 30% of their income. And which makes a lot of sense, because I feel like anecdotally, mortgages are going up, especially with interest rates going up. And so what are some of the causes that got us here? Because I don't think it's just one thing. And so what did you find in this report of like how we got to this point?
Yeah. So one of the things, the big driver of this is really demographics. You know, we did a report in the fall looking at the state's workforce and workforce age population. And we're on a path to, by 2030, have 130,000 fewer 25 to 64 year olds in the state. That's the prime working age population. And so when we put that out, one of the questions we got from a lot of people was, well, that's going to really make the housing shortages and housing affordability, you know, that's going to, you know, make housing more affordable because we're not going to have the demand we did. And they forgot that, yes, there's this big baby boom generation leaving the workforce, but they're going to stay in, like generations past, they're going to stay in their homes for, you know, another 10, 15, 20 years. And so even though that prime workforce population is going to shrink, unless we do something about it, we're still going to need to build, you know, 140,000 housing units just to have homes for the young people that'll be coming into the workforce. So that's that's not even considering affordability. So that's just the number that we're going to need. Now, when you talk about affordable housing, that's where the whole supply and demand comes in. And one of the things that's been, you know, driving the inaffordability to some degree, you know, is, again, it goes back to the baby boom generation. You know, they're moving often when they retire to be near their kids. And so, you know, they're coming into places and driving up home prices. And that, you know, makes it unaffordable in some cases for young people. Now, you mentioned the interest rate issue. That's more recent.
Yeah.
And that's causing a, you know, that's really putting a lot of housing out of reach for a lot of young people, just because, you know, you're looking at a housing payment that may have doubled compared to 2 years ago, what it would have been.
So then, because on the high end, I think the minimum for the report found is 140,000 units.
Yeah.
The high end was like 227,000, right?
Yeah. So
go ahead.
No, so that's, and that's, you know, because again, as I just said, this 140 is really the minimum that we need. If we're happy that our prime working age population is going to decline by 130,000, we're not going to do anything about it. That's what we need. But that workforce problem is going to create all kinds of problems throughout the economy. And so we have to do something about that. And the only way to do that is through migration. You know, having more kids, it's going to take 20 years to create a worker out of that, the new kids. So you have to have housing for them. So to completely solve that problem adds another 50, 60, 70,000 housing units in terms of need. And then we have a third component, which really goes to the affordable housing. The number of young people, young adults under age 35, that are living at home, probably temporarily, you know, just out of college, et cetera, has gone up significantly over the last decade, both here and nationally. And the primary driver of that is the lack of affordable housing. They can't find housing that fits within their budget given their incomes. And that's a problem that again, that needs to be solved. And that adds another 20,000 housing units. So if we want to try to solve kind of all of our problems, you're getting up to 227,000 housing units. And, you know, a big, big chunk of those have to be affordable housing. They can't be the, you know, if it's a single family home, you know, it can't be the $400,000, $500,000 home. It's got to be something that's affordable. So it's this dual challenge here, really.
And so, and I asked this when we were talking about condos, and maybe condos and the thing that what it was talked about in Milwaukee is a different issue, but it seems like kind of the bigger question is the same of like, who's responsible for building affordable housing? Like, whose charter is it to start to address this problem? And, you know, for the developers, as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece said, when specifically talking about condos, is it's more profitable to make apartments versus condos. But like, even for duplexes or condos or single family homes. And so if we need to be building more, who's responsible for building and making sure that what they're building can be in that lower range so people can afford to buy them?
Sure. I mean, really, a lot of it, a lot of it goes to municipal officials. For a couple of reasons. You know, one is before we can even build homes, they have to be creating lots, creating subdivisions, et cetera. And that's one of the challenges that we faced over the last decade is we haven't created enough lots to meet the demand. And that's been helping to drive up prices. But then, you know, part of this is the size of the lot. A lot of places, a lot of communities like larger lots, we're seeing, and thus larger homes, that makes them less affordable. And sometimes there's a lot of restrictions in terms of building that drive up costs. So there is that on the municipal side. And then the builder side, they generally make more money off of building bigger homes. So there's clearly a desire to do that. And given lumber prices, given labor shortages, and so wages for carpenters, et cetera, going up, you know, it's a challenge to build. If you're talking about single family homes, it's a challenge to build, you know, a new home, you know, that's of some decent size. You know, maybe it's, you know, 1,500 square feet. That seems like an affordable price. It's the economics of it are really challenging. And generally then they don't make as much money off of that. So it's not blame, but there's a lot of competing forces out there. And you know, the other thing is when you have communities now that for years have had homes that are of a certain size or whatever, oftentimes when municipalities look to bring in apartment buildings, et cetera, it's not generally the local officials that are opposed, what they're looking to do that, but their constituents often don't want the apartments there. And so, you know, they put pressure on the local officials, you know, not to approve those kinds of things. And that's a challenge in a lot of places.
And I want to get to that next, but we're talking to Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. And not that this is your opinion, but as far as in your research, why do homeowners typically, is there any data that points to an apartment unit in a neighborhood decreasing home value? That there is kind of this NIMBYism when it comes to either zoning or apartment buildings or mixed use and having duplexes and stuff. So like, what is the, as you said, less than the local officials, but more of the constituents who don't want that. What well-founded reasoning do they have to not want that?
Well, in terms of the residents that are in the immediate vicinity, what you're talking about is often, a relatively large amount of traffic coming from, because the apartment building is there, compared to single family homes. So, that's one of the reasons, and there's a variety of reasons, but, the home values, there's so many factors that go into home values. And, you can look at home values in general would go up if you have more young people in the community who ultimately will be home buyers and will drive up demand for single family homes. Almost everybody started in an apartment. That's important. And in Wisconsin, the way we fund schools, et cetera, you want to have those young people here with young families. Often they're starting out in apartments, but that helps drive the funding of your schools and you get better schools, and that drives up home prices. So it can work in a couple of different ways. But I think it's the traffic issues for the people that are immediately there in the area, that's one of the driving factors.
And then my last question, Dale, is in your research for this paper, this report, is there any communities in Wisconsin that are making headway or starting to address this problem successfully?
There's two counties in Wisconsin that there's a lot of communities that are trying to figure this out, and they're approaching it different ways. Surprisingly, there's two counties that are already doing something, putting together programs. Washington County and Sheboygan County are working, putting money towards and trying to figure out how to ensure that there's affordable housing in their communities. And normally the counties don't get involved with this, but they're doing some innovative things, and started by looking at what's driving the affordability problem, and they're at the beginning of that process, but they're I think moving in the right direction. I think we'll see more counties sort of get involved in that.
All right, well, Dale Knapp, who is the director of Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association, thank you so much for joining us today. We will link the report, A Housing Hurdle, Demographics Drive, Need for More Homes, on today's episode blog. But thank you so much for spending time with us and trying to demystify this issue.
It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. All right, well, we're going to take another break. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
What's your favorite thing about a good movie? What makes the perfect song? And what's it about the first lines of a book that will snatch our attention? If these questions intrigued your artsy interest, you don't want to miss Director's Cut on WFHR every Sunday night from 8 to 9. Your WFHR program director, James, and head of production, Seth, will be diving into the local arts and entertainment, hot topic movies, hidden gems, and more. Audience feedback and requests are encouraged for this fun and open conversation about art in all its forms. It's artists supporting artists, in their own words.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
I'm a wife and the mother of two kids. And when I get to work in the precinct house and put on my uniform, I can tell you, as a police officer, we're building partnerships. This should be happening everywhere. So the police should be reaching out to this community. And this community should reach out to the police. That's the way to make this a safer place.
Start the conversation and help stop crime. To learn the five things you can do, go to ncpc.org/preventviolentcrime. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the Bureau of Justice Assistance.
This is Matt LePay, and you're listening to your home for your Wisconsin Badgers on 97.5 FM and 1320 AM WFHR, locally grown radio.
It's for News Talk Radio, streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin on the Civic Media Network. A reminder that we love hearing from you. If you have a topic that we should cover or a guest that we should have on, let us know. We likely will follow through on that. And also, if you missed this announcement earlier, we are giving away free ad space. Yes. No catch. Don't tell me that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Because the Civic Media Network, in our growing stations across Wisconsin, means that we have ad space that we want to use to bolster and lift up small businesses across Wisconsin. And so how does this work? What does this actually mean? So on January 26th.
It's a Thursday.
Thursday at 9 a.m., civicmedia.us applications will be open. You have to fill out a couple questions, and then you will work with the Civic Media sales team to develop your radio promo and what that would sound like on air. And literally, it's free ad space. So you get to promote your business for free. And so there's no reason you should not do this.
There's an important caveat, though.
There is an important caveat. So if you're going to do it, I need you to do one important thing. It's maybe the most important thing when you're doing the application. Which is to say that Jane and Kristen on As Goes Wisconsin sent you. That's very, very important because it's not really a competition. Like, I don't think we're going to win anything beyond bragging rights.
It's about bragging
but
rights.
But it really is about bragging rights. And we've already discussed that I come from a very competitive family. I'm a very competitive person. And so when you go on Thursday, January 26th to civicmedia.us on the $1 million ad giveaway, fill out all your information. But make sure you tell them As Goes Wisconsin sent you.
We were the ones. Yes.
So just to wrap up our conversation around housing, was that a lot? Was that too much housing for one show?
It was so informative. It really was.
It's so interesting because it's something that we all need. And, you know, there's a conversation around housing being a human right. And especially affordable housing and the different markets and how market forces are changing and everything. But it's also complicated. And so trying to understand the moving habits and the working habits and the transit habits and how all of this is connected. And so having people who are, you know, obviously looking backwards at certain ways of how we got here and then looking forward towards the next decade of how we're going to manage all of this. And so I think having these conversations. And also, I think when we talk about the residents, constituents, homeowners who have, you know, trepidation towards new developments, considering, like, it kind of just comes back to, I don't know, it comes back to being, I think, a collectivist and thinking, like, what is best for the community? Because if you're not going to embrace more affordable housing, don't turn around and complain about homeless population increasing. you know, and some of the negative externalities when there's not places for people to live, what that leads to.
Well, and what Dale shared with us, I think the most hopeful thing was that we have some counties now that are getting involved, yeah, and trying to come up with some plans, because I can see it in my own little neighborhood.
Really?
Well, there's one little house, and it's little. I mean, teeny little. Like, the kitchen is so small, you can't put a kitchen table in it.
Oh, you've seen this house?
I've seen
this
house.
Inside, okay.
Yep. And it sold last year for $265,000.
Oh, wow.
And
probably not that long ago, it was under $100,000.
Or at least $150,000.
Yeah.
And how is that going to be sustainable?
Yeah.
If the current owner can't sell it for $280,000 or $290,000 or $300,000, I just don't see, again, how this is sustainable unless we're all going to become programmers.
Making that $900,000.
Making $900,000. Yeah, well, or the head of Wisconsin We Energies and make $12 million a year.
That's how much the We Energy CEO makes?
There was, I don't know about the current one, but I'm fairly certain that for previous CEOs, yes. Oh, yeah, pretty good job.
Good work if you can get it.
Exactly. Even if you only do it for a year.
Yeah, seriously. Well, one thing we could all do is just, even if you're not in a, you know, marriage or in a relationship, maybe you could buy a house with some friends or a sibling, because that is a growing, not phenomenon, a growing trend. A recent Zillow survey shows that co-buying or purchasing a home with someone you're not in a romantic relationship with,
okay,
is incredibly common. 18% of recent home buyers purchased with a relative or friend. About 1 in 5 up-and-coming buyers said they intend to.
Wow.
And this is according to the Housing Innovation Collaborative. And so would you... I feel like I see jokes and memes every once in a while, of, especially for women, of like running off and starting your own commune with all your friends and like owning property, and we can all raise each other's kids, and kind of this idealist fantasy of what that could look like. But like, could you actually, is there a friend that you feel like you're like, I would buy a home with them? Because it's one thing, because a roommate situation, you can always, there's less skin in the game.
Right. I love my girlfriends so much, and they save my life every day. And no, I couldn't live with any of them. I could probably do that with one of my sisters.
Why your sister? Is it just because you can fight differently with your sisters because they're family than
I think
your
we
friends?
Can, because you can be a little blunter, maybe. And we're family. I don't know. Not all of my siblings. Trust me, I couldn't live with all of my siblings. And they would say the same thing about me.
Not even live with. Co-own something.
Oh, no. No. And you have to be so careful if you do that. Money does twitchy things to people.
Well, and that's why it's interesting. I mean, money does twitchy things in marriages, right?
Yes.
Like, the number one reason, like, listed for divorce is usually money issues and talking about money and different relationships with money. And it's almost the same thing as when you, the advice of don't go into business with family or friends.
Right.
Because if you approach the business differently and you have different ideas and there's butting of heads, that what seemed like a good idea in the beginning and only looking at the upside can end relationships.
Absolutely.
Because what do you do in a situation of, like, what is legally do you get to? Because in a divorce, obviously, there's an end of that relationship. And so, like, the courts get involved as far as breaking up the house.
You got to have some kind of contract.
Yeah. So,
And the other thing to live by, don't loan anyone money if you can't afford not to get it back.
Advice from Jane Matinair. All right. Well, we're going to take another break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, moving on from the housing conversation, let's talk about some Packers. Mr. Aaron Nagler from Cheesehead TV. We started the season with him. We're going to end the season with him. He's going to be here to tell us what he would do if he were the GM of the Packers. And then it's National Bootlegger Day. So I thought we'd revisit the conversation around how Prohibition really bolstered the Packers 100 years ago. All right, this is As Goes Wisconsin.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. At 4 in the morning, my phone rang. They said, "I regret to inform you that your husband was wounded in action." Victor sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. I was doing school full time, and I was also then caring for Victor. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself. I just didn't want to forget that I also had goals and that I also had a life. What I did is I challenged Victor to meet me halfway. There are almost 6 million military and veteran caregivers across the nation. We have our own journey, and we can fulfill that journey at the same time that we are helping our loved one.
Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP.
WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM. Serving